and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films, and occasionally TV. My name's Christopher Webb, and with me is my old friend. Yes, friend, acquaintance, comrade, companion, chum. It's Robert Johnson.
Hello, Chris, you old stinker.
How are you, man?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm pretty good, just keeping busy. Spring has arrived, which is nice.
It's lovely.
Sun's been out today, and it's been a bit of a hot one, which is lovely.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. How are you? How's that new little baby of yours?
Oh, he's lovely. He's letting us get quite a bit more sleep at the moment, so that's wonderful. Catching up on a whole lot of prestige television that I've not been able to watch, and even a few movies, and yeah, I haven't known what to do with ourselves, really. So no, he's doing very good. 5 months and a couple of days.
I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Because it was just at the start of lockdown when he appeared, wasn't it? So, incredible.
Yeah. Level 4 lockdown, baby. So, I couldn't help but notice on the introduction that you did refer to not just fondly remembered films, but on occasion television.
Yeah, you were surprised about that, weren't you?
Well, I always know when that introduction is at hand that it's going to be one of our special episodes, isn't it?
Yes, because it's mid-September, which means it's Roald Dahl Day, which means that once again we follow on our tradition. This is our third year of doing this, of reviewing some episodes of Tales of the Unexpected.
Well, hey!
I do like doing these ones.
I do too. I think, you know, we've missed the trick here. I mean, I know it's a podcast and people can't see us, but, you know, we really should both be under a blanket with a wooden tray on our laps, various sort of pencils and papers on it. And
next to a roaring fireplace.
Next to a roaring fireplace, looking like we haven't moved for about 4 days, haven't showered.
Well, I've got that bit right.
Yeah. Such a comforting intro.
It's lovely, isn't it? It really disarms you for what's about to come next, I think.
It does, yeah.
So in line with what we traditionally do, there are two episodes to discuss. The only sort of slight change with this is you didn't choose one. Partly because I think you've exhausted your list of Tales of the Unexpected.
I am spent.
Yeah.
I am spent. But being just a youthful 39 years old, I've basically run through my back catalogue of episodes, yeah.
So as far as this one goes, I've chosen one, but also somebody else chose one who can't be with us today.
Oh.
So we went and watched that as well.
Carl Reiner?
That's right. It's not one of those. I don't think anyone from these episodes has passed away recently. I don't think so, anyway. I'll have to check. So the first one, which was chosen by a third party who will remain nameless, is from season 2, and it is The Umbrella Man. Because it's an early one, it featured Roald Dahl, as we've already mentioned, sat by the fire with his little tea tray.
It is very seldom that a short story writer is able to make anything worthwhile out of an incident that actually happened. But this story is one of the rare exceptions. I myself met the Umbrella Man on a street in New York City, and I followed him, just as in this story, and I was delighted and amazed by what I found. I must confess to you that I tried the same experiment myself a few days later to see if it really worked, and it did. I only hope that on the next rainy day that comes along, we won't have thousands of you going out and doing the same thing. It would cause chaos in the land.
Yeah, he really set the bar quite high with that.
Yeah, you think you're going to see like a terrorist attack or something.
You think you're going to see some sort of paranormal activity or some absolute feats of human daring do. Yeah,
something really sinister is clearly on the way.
Suffice to say, it's a little bit more pedestrian.
Yes.
He's a man who is actually quite easily astonished, it would seem.
But do you believe he tried it and it worked?
It's hard to believe he tried it, isn't it? I mean, I scarcely believe that he actually even saw it happening. It's not even all that deviously clever con at all. So, like, on one hand, yeah, I can believe that perhaps people go around doing this without, you know, getting into spoilers already. It's not that different to sort of just begging on the street, give me some money so I can get some bus fare, and then just going and, you know, getting a pie with it. It's not Ocean's 12, you know?
No. Look, the pie man does actually sound quite an interesting concept.
Yeah.
I followed him all the way to Greg's, and it worked.
Yeah, as I was watching this, I was kind of waiting for the really big twist to hit me, and it was just never quite came.
There isn't really a twist. There's nothing that unexpected that happens.
It's also unusual, I guess, in that I guess you could almost say it has a happy ending. Yeah, it doesn't really have a sinister ending. There's no real sinister, nasty element to it. It's a very slight, very whimsical episode of Tales of the Unexpected, not as menacing or uneasy as a lot of them. It's no Flypaper.
It could be, no, shit, no. With a couple of tweaks, it could be an episode of a sitcom.
It could be, a subplot in an episode of Friends. You know, Phoebe.
Yeah!
It could be Phoebe's plot, you know, the C-plot in an episode of Friends.
Hey, Phoebe, where'd you get all those $5 from? Like, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, that's the level that we're at here with this one.
So I suppose we should talk about it.
Yeah.
This first appeared in Roald Dahl's More Tales from the Unexpected in 1980, which was coincidentally the same year that this was produced.
Yeah.
It was adapted by Ronald Harwood, who wrote The Dresser and The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. Do you know what happened to Ronald Harwood this week?
Oh, God.
He died.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, I knew there was one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Every time.
All right. R.I.P. Ronald. So, Chris, do you remember this one at all from first time around?
Kind of. I remember John Mills walking around in the street. But there are a couple of John Mills episodes, so maybe I was sort of confusing the two, because there's another one with John Mills called Galloping Foxley, which I do remember, which is one where he's an old man who's troubled by having suffered abuse while he was in a public school, in a boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that one in particular, because it's got Damien from Omen 2 in it.
Okay.
But that's another very slight episode where John Mills sees this man on the train every day and says, I'm convinced that's Foxley from my school days and he'd made my life hell. And so there's a lot of flashbacks where he's being just beaten by this bully. And he says, I'm going to confront him. So right at the end of the episode, he goes, you bullied me every day at school. And this bloke goes, nah, sorry, mate, it wasn't me. And then it ends.
It sounds like an alternative of the next episode we're doing, almost.
Exactly, I think that's maybe what came to mind as well. But I do vaguely remember this one. But it is part of my now famous DVD box set of Tales of the Unexpected, so it was a nice easy one for me to find. So I do kind of remember it. What about you? Any memories of this one?
No, none at all, no. Really, the only ones I do remember are those sort of original season, which you loaned me, actually, many years ago. That randomly, that Tom Bosley episode, which we covered off last year? Was that last year?
We did.
So this was a new experience for me. Both these episodes were.
Okay, well, but, that's good.
The great thing, of course, is recognising the cast members.
Yes.
Because there's some... A who's who of British stage and cinema.
Most definitely. And it starts with a big one. Is it a hotel? It's like a lobby, but is it a hotel? Is it like a hostel or a doss house?
It's sort of like a boarding house.
Yeah.
Or like a scummy kind of lodging house.
The clerk is sleeping in the chair behind the counter. Then John Mills turns up, dressed like a tweed gentleman from the olden days. He rings the bell and says he wants a room for the night. And then he asks for a list of pubs in the area. And the clerk seems a little bit confused. He doesn't really seem to know what pubs are. He goes, what? Pubs? John Mills has to play this quick game of taboo, sort of using other names for pubs, just so he knows what they are. She's going like, inns, hostelries, public houses, pubs. And so he finally cottons on and just goes, all right, here's the yellow pages. Off you go.
Yeah. I thought that was the first twist of the episode, that we're in an alternative Britain without pubs.
Where pubs don't exist,
So he's in the multiverse.
That would bring London to its knees, wouldn't it? So then he sort of settles into his room, and then he asks the clerk if he knows what the weather forecast's going to be. And rather shockingly, the clerk doesn't really know what a weather forecast is either.
Yeah.
Is this a hostel? Is this guy just an inmate in some kind of institution? Because he doesn't really understand the grasp of anything.
I just think he must have some sort of degenerative brain disease or something. Yeah.
it almost feels like a 70s sitcom where John Mills has gone on holiday to Spain and they don't know the lingo. It's like, pubs, ¿qué? Pubs, señor. It's very strange.
Yeah, almost Python-esque.
Yeah, so then we see John Mills. He's got a little town map and he's marking all the pubs on it. So he's like doing the Golden Mile from the World's End. He's just marking which pubs he's going to be going to.
And, I mean, it's a nice little performance from John Mills. I mean, he could do it, you know, with his eyes closed and one arm tied behind his back. But it's a nice... He's well cast. It's nice.
Yeah. People normally say performances like, you could read the phone book and I'd listen to it. And in this, he actually does read the phone book. So they're right.
Indeed.
And then we're off to a typical sort of waiting room in a railway station. And what is traditional with Roald Dahl episodes is everyone's very, very posh. There's a very posh husband and wife, Arthur and Wendy, who are looking a bit sort of Farage-y as they go in. He looks a bit like Nigel Farage.
He does a bit, yeah.
Nice couple.
Not a lot of ethnic diversity in these.
Not in Dahl's world, no. No, there isn't. Even the man who doesn't understand English is English. Yeah. But she's looking wistfully out of the window.
Yeah.
And then, would you believe it, young Dumbledore walks in.
Yeah.
A very young Michael Gambon, or Andrew, as he's playing in this. With his little moustache and a nice sort of tie and blazer badge combination.
Looking a bit more Michael Gammon than Michael Gambon.
Very good. So you think him and Arthur would get on famously, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think so.
So then there's some sort of general weather banter and various references to Andrew bringing an umbrella, and they all have a laugh at him and they say, well, it's not going to rain, ha ha ha, you have an umbrella. So there's a few umbrella conversations going on. Arthur goes to get some coffee, leaving Andrew and Wendy alone in the waiting room. And then they just sort of go, darling, darling, I love you.
darling.
They say darling about 10 times each.
That's very Charles and Camilla.
Oh, sort of absolutely.
When Diana went off to, you know, go to the loo or something.
Yeah. So he sort of says to her, when are we going to meet? I mean, properly. And he sort of almost does the quotey fingers over the word properly. I think we know what he means.
Yeah.
And she says she fancies it at lunchtime, but damnation. He has a business lunch in the pub, so he can't make it. But I thought, surely there's like a disabled toilet they could sneak into to meet properly. Surely.
You'd hope so.
So we know there's something going on. And then they start doing this sort of sexy crossword innuendo.
Mm.
So, 'cause Andrew's sort of getting Wendy to read smut at four across, basically. He's writing filth in his crossword and getting her to read it. So then we're back at the Doss house. And John Mill plays another game of taboo with the clerk by trying to guess what a church is.
Yeah.
He just runs through this whole, your houses of worship, chapels. I don't understand. I don't get it.
Was this supposed to be sort of side-splittingly funny dialogue, perhaps?
Possibly, yeah. But he wants one of these because he's praying for rain. Not really sure why, but he's trying to find a church so he can pray for rain. And it works, because we're then straight into a very posh village street. Again, as we've always mentioned in these Tales of the Unexpected, they're always in these like posh villages in Norfolk or somewhere like that. These very little villages. And Wendy's there. She's had her hair done. She's very, very happy with her hairdo. She comes out very happy. And luckily, she's got one of those head scarves that they used to have in the 70s and 80s to cover her head, to protect her hair from the rain. And John Mills appears from behind her. And he sort of says, oh, hello, madam. He's very polite. But he says, hello, I wonder if I could ask a small favour. And she immediately, just by the look of his tweed suit and his very, very posh accent, says, well, I don't give to beggars. Because he clearly looks like a beggar. He's after that money for a pie, isn't he? But he doesn't really help himself by saying that he's not a beggar, but he has forgotten his wallet. And he's trying to butter her up by saying that she's attractive, but possessed of a certain sadness with some form of unrequited love.
Yeah, wow, very astute. Very perceptive, yeah.
I need money, and you clearly need an umbrella. He offers to sell her an umbrella for £5.
Because he wants a cab there? Yeah, poor old legs of it, so.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, legs, pins, femurs, you know, they're a bit sore. But he says then, well, it's a good deal because it cost him £20. And I thought, in 1980, £20? This is made of solid gold.
I'm no mathematician or economist, but that's got to be at least $3,500 these days.
Well, I am a mathematician, and you're absolutely right. That is exactly how much it would cost, yeah. He finally wins her over because he says quite a nice line, which is, "No man is worth the tears of a beautiful woman." She's not crying, she's not upset, she's just happy with her hairdo. So I'm not really sure where that came from. Yeah. Maybe it'll come up later, who knows?
Yeah, it's still a good line, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very good line, yeah. So she thinks, fair enough, she's got her umbrella. She's given him £5 for a taxi. But he doesn't get a taxi. He goes to the pub.
Tavern. Inn.
Tavern. Yeah. Hostelry. His house. But later on, she sees him doing exactly the same thing. He's selling an umbrella to a woman with nice hair.
Is the nice hair a key part of the...
I think it is, yeah. He's prayed for rain and nice hair.
Yes, yes, yeah.
So very much like Roald Dahl, she follows him. She follows him to the pub. And this is, I suppose, what's kind of regarded as the unexpected bit. She sees him steal an umbrella from the umbrella stand by the door.
Bloody hell.
So that's his big money-making scam. Stealing umbrellas and selling them for £5. If this was pitched on Dragon's Den, they're not going to invest.
No. I'm out. Duncan Bannatyne would be
The cash flow flaws, such as the expenses, they'd be highlighted in a heartbeat, wouldn't they? He's got no chance to get him invest in this. So then we're straight back with Arthur and Andrew. Arthur is soaked through to the skin because he was scoffing at Andrew for bringing an umbrella and not having one of his own. But Andrew is also soaked. And he says because his umbrella was stolen from the pub. And apparently the police station have had several complaints. Not sure about what.
First thing you'd do when your umbrella was stolen from the pub, call the cops.
Yeah, that's right. 999 straight away. But then Wendy turns up with her nice hair intact and an umbrella.
Yeah.
So Arthur puts the pieces together and somehow, from the fact that she's got an umbrella, deduces that they've been having it off. Yeah. Not that she's just gone and bought an umbrella, which would be the obvious answer.
I found this a little bit of a tenuous sort of smoking gun moment myself.
But Arthur goes mental. He calls Andrew a swine. He says he's going to take him to court as a co-respondent. And his evidence is she's got an umbrella.
I know. It was really went from 0 to 100 very, very quickly.
Yeah. The fact that he's right is kind of irrelevant. No court in the land would buy this, surely. But Andrew doesn't help it by saying he doesn't give a fig for Wendy. He also says that he doesn't like being accused of treachery. Which really, you accuse me of treachery. So they go to the police station. Let's go to the police station as well. Because in reality, he'd just go, oh, fuck off, she's just bought an umbrella. There would be none of this. He doth protest too much.
Yeah. It's not like it's a monogrammed umbrella. I mean, it is an expensive silk umbrella, but it's not like it's got a screen print of Michael Gambon's face on it. I mean...
Yeah, his mum hasn't written his name on the label inside anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It might not even be his. It would be a hell of a coincidence if he was in pub. It's just an umbrella. So they go to the police station. And the first person we see is Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill, or Hitler, as you would probably know him.
Yeah, Hitler. I know him as Hitler, yeah.
Yeah. But he's also playing taboo, because he's describing John Mills as the major, the commander, the rural dean, the chief inspector, which sounds like sort of different positions that Arthur and Wendy might have done at lunchtime.
It does, yeah, or nicknames for his penis.
Let's do the rural dean today, shall we? So they're there, and of course Andrew is reporting the fact that his umbrella was stolen and that Wendy bought one from the umbrella man. So she's asked to identify him. They bring in John Mills, who's been arrested, but she does remember that Andrew says that he doesn't give a fig, and so she's not going to help him out. So she says she doesn't recognise him. She doesn't recognise John Mills. I'm not sure how it's going to help anybody out, because it doesn't.
No.
But apparently that is then proof of treachery and not just someone else who sold her an umbrella in the street.
It's all a bit... strange.
Yeah. So Andrew's very upset by this, and he says, well, how could you? And she says, how could you? And then repeats that no man is worth line back to John Mills to say that, well, you have had a remarkable effect on me. I realise that I've been wasting away my life with a man who says that he doesn't give a fig. So we're back at the Doss house at the end, and John Mills has obviously had a good day.
Yeah.
Because he hands over a massive wad of fivers to the clerk. So... a lot of umbrellas must have been sold that day. And I was a little bit surprised that the clerk didn't go, "What's this? What have you just given me?" And
he'd go, "Money. Money. Currency.
Cash.
Pounds.
Dosh. Moolah. Dwayne Eddy.
De Niro."
Yeah. And then it ends.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just says, "I'm off to Manchester because it always rains in Manchester." And then it ends.
So, well, we've already said it was a pretty slight one. Two plot lines that they don't dovetail in a very elegant way at all. Totally illogical plot that just relies on a whole heap of coincidences and a con that I just... unsustainable con.
But the strange thing about this one is it's absolutely nothing like the short story. I know you've read a lot of the short stories. Have you read this one?
I have read this one, yeah. It's just a mother and a daughter and the umbrella.
She's going to, a 12-year-old girl's going to the dentist and they follow the umbrella man. The end. There's nothing about married couples having it away. We don't follow the private life of the umbrella man. So pretty much everything in this has been invented by the late Ronald Harwood. And it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. The short story makes much more sense on its own. And it's sort of a comment on, I guess, the gullibility of people. Even sort of the mother is presented as sort of a bit of a cynical kind of street smart woman, and she still gets taken in by the umbrella man, and you know, it's quite no pretensions to anything else. Whereas they feel, I guess they feel with this, they've had to, because Tales of the Unexpected is known for a bit of adult content, a bit of, you know, infidelity, a bit of what have you, they tried to put something a little more edgy into it to flesh it out, and it just doesn't work. So need I ask, is this still any good, Chris, the umbrella man?
No, it's not. No. It's got its pluses. John Mills is suitably charming. Michael Gambon is sort of suitably camp.
Yeah.
But no, it, like you said, those two things have just been pasted together.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, and as you said, the whole gotcha moment with Arthur thinking he's proven their infidelity, even though he's right, it just is the hugest leap, and it's just totally bad writing.
It is. Yeah. It's like a first draft.
Yeah.
There could have been so many other ways you could have included the theft of the umbrella to make it, I don't know, more Jeopardy, more interesting, more frightening, have something with a satisfying twist than just, I think you're having an affair with my wife because your umbrella's been stolen.
Yeah.
It's a nonsense. When you compare it to some of the other episodes where there's much more of a gruesome outcome or a more satisfying outcome, this is so slight.
And I've got no problem with the slightness if it's sort of whimsical and works and makes sense. You know, I've got no problem with a slight, fluffy episode, but it just makes no sense.
There's no satisfaction. There's no winners.
For me, the only thing that really stuck with me out of this episode was just the curiosity of seeing a young Michael Gambon, really.
Yeah. Because he's quite funny in it, but
yeah, but you know, usually the beauty of sort of these Tales of the Unexpected episodes are they're only 25 minutes long, and they usually sort of whiz by. I actually felt every minute of this one.
It's really padded out,
isn't it? This could have been a 6-minute episode, not a 26 minute one,
because that's what the short story is. The short story is like a page and a half
It's ridiculous.
But no, you're right, not good.
I wonder what Roald Dahl thought of this. He probably just thought, well, I'll take the paycheck, the payment, the invoice, the contract,
the stipend,
the fee.
Is it still any good? Is it still any good? Is it still any good with Rob and Chris? Is it still any good? Shall we move on to the second one?
We shall.
Now, this is quite similar to you with last year when we discussed your choice, which was Lightfingers, where you sort of misremembered some of the aspects of that episode. Well, with this one, I'll hold my hand up and say I completely misremembered the entire episode.
Oh, wow.
I thought it was a weird dreamlike episode with Denham Elliot and Lucy Gutteridge, which involved some problems he had with his wife.
Hillary?
Yeah, Hillary Flamond. But it turns out that's an old Hammer House of Horror episode. And when I watched it, I thought, oh, I don't remember this at all.
In fact, I've never seen it.
But once I did watch it, I remembered it quite clearly as one that disturbed me as a child. So I did recall it, but it wasn't the one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
But the one that I did, or the title of the one that I chose, and the one that we have now watched, is called The Stinker.
We'll call him the Stinker.
Stinker is a sniffling telltale. A stinker is a slimy disgrace to the community. A stinker fails in everything he tries.
I can't tell you how good it is to see you again.
Jack Cutler meant to destroy me, and he very nearly succeeded.
If you ask me, I think he's trying to make amends for being so beastly to you at school.
Made my life a misery.
Then take the job, please. For my sake, I want a bit of life before I die.
I must say, that dress is really...
Well, he's a lovely man anyway, very sexy.
He's a bit old for you.
Tinker Stinker. Are you sure it wasn't a comment on his performance with girls? I bet it wasn't a patch on yours.
Still don't like him.
David couldn't go blubbing home, could he? He stood there and he slew Goliath. And that's what you're gonna do.
Tinker Stinker. Tinker Stinker. Tinker Stinker.
Stinker, stinker, holy Moses, halt on the wicked. Stinker, stinker, holy Moses, halt on the wicked. Stinker, stinker, holy Moses, halt on the wicked.
I am a stinker.
It's from the third series.
Yeah.
So we don't have Dahl by the fireplace introducing, and it's not written by Roald Dahl.
No.
It's written by Julian Simons, who's quite a prolific crime novelist and a biographer.
Yeah.
A man who seems to know what he's doing. I think he's sort of ghost-written Agatha Christie and stuff as well. He's written various sort of Poirots and things. So
He's
a man who knows how to write.
Yeah.
How to write things with a twist in the tale, so it seems.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this one, should we talk about who's in it, or should we just get into the episode? Well, is this one that you'd seen before?
I hadn't seen it in any way at all?
No
memory of it, never heard of it, hadn't seen it.
Okay.
Very intrigued by the cast. You know, I mean, I love a good Denham Elliott's performance. He's very well cast in this role, I think.
Oh, and then, he is, yeah.
And they're almost playing to type, almost, aren't they? Because then Joss Ackland, again, I was like quite intrigued to see him in this, a youngish Joss Ackland. And he plays exactly who you sort of imagine Joss Ackland would be.
Yeah, he is revolting.
He's revolting. But, you know, without giving anything away, there's something sympathetic about him, sort of. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sort of something likeable and human about him.
Yes, there is, yeah.
There's something redeemable, just enough to make it so he's not a cartoonish bore. And then, and then of course, Patricia Quinn of Rocky Horror Picture Show fame, of
Magenta,
I Claudius, and other things.
She's also, I did read, I didn't know this at the time, she's the headmaster's wife in the sex education scene in The Meaning of Life.
Oh, is she?
Yeah.
I would have thought I would have remembered that, but...
she's upside down, yeah. So it's quite difficult.
Yeah. But
so, yeah, this one, The Stinker... It's another one of those that's filmed in one of these lovely little Norfolk villages. Mm. You can tell that from the little red buses and stuff that are going past. And Denham Elliott is playing a man called Harold Tinker.
Mm.
It's a good example of the name of a character perfectly sums up what they're like. If you think of someone called Mr. Tinker, you know they're going to be very small, very mousy, very hesitant. And Denham Elliott plays that beautifully.
He does.
And so we first see him, he's walking along the street and he's sort of aimlessly feeding the ducks.
Mm.
He's got a bag with his sandwiches, he's throwing bread to the ducks. And then a Rolls goes past and he spots the man in the back, which is Jack Cutler, played by Joss Ackland.
Yeah.
Couldn't see if he had diplomatic plates on the car or not.
I was reading about Joss Ackland. You know, he and his wife lived in South Africa for a few years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so he had some personal experience to draw on when he was saying diplomatic immunity.
That's real research, living there for a few years. It is. Amazing. Yeah.
And also his wife jumped out of, they had a house fire. She saved one of the children, jumped out of a window, broke her back or her legs or something.
Jesus.
So he was married to his wife for like 50 years or something. And he said that they never had a night apart. Yeah, she was pregnant at the time. They said she would never walk again and she would miscarry. She had the baby. She walked again within 2 years. It was
crazy.
Yeah. Totally irrelevant to this episode, but
that's amazing.
I was very fascinated about Joss Ackland's wife.
Yeah.
Rosemary. Rosemary, yeah.
Rosemary, okay, okay. And Rosemary's Baby was okay.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby was fine, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Thank God for that.
Yeah.
Thank the devil for that. So he sees Joss Ackler, or Jack Cutler, just puffing away on his Henry Winterman cigar or his Hamlet in the back of the car.
Yeah.
And they seem to recognise each other.
Without knowing what was sort of to come in the episode, the way they look at each other, it's almost like two lovers. Two sort of, they really look, a very loaded look.
Ships that pass in the night, absolutely, yeah. So Joss Ackland leaps out of his car and shouts, "Stinker!" Which I'm definitely going to do now. Well, if I fart and I've got the kids in the car,
I just
gonna go stinker.
That's what I thought had happened. He just done a fart in the car.
He's just cut one, yeah. But then, as soon as he shouts stinker, Denham Elliot looks quite horrified. And then we get a flashback to public school life. And it looks like a changing room after a rugby match. And he's clearly grassed up the lads for something. Yeah. He's dobbed them in. And they decide to get their revenge on him. Which, a group of public school boys in a changing room after a rugby match, you're going to fear the worst.
Yeah, but it's quite tame.
Yeah, all they do is call him a name that sounds a little bit like his. He's got off quite lightly.
Yeah.
I mean, even, his surname ends in N-K-E-R. They could have come up with a completely different nickname for him. It's quite a safe option.
Yeah, I mean, considering sort of one of them's holding a cricket wicket at one point, I mean...
Yeah.
Things could have really gone south.
Yeah, it could have gone pear-shaped. Absolutely, yeah. Could have gone south. Sorry, I will stop giggling because that's horrific. But young Cutler appears to be the ringleader.
Yeah.
And they start chanting in his face and say after me, "A stinker is a slimy disgrace to the community. A stinker fails in everything he tries. You are a stinker." The swines,
just,
eh?
I'm just trying to picture 14-year-old boys saying that today. Yeah, stinking is a disgrace to the community. A stinker fails at everything he tries. I mean, yeah, it's pretty tame.
But it's clearly left a marked effect on poor Harold Tinker, because he does appear to be a failure in everything he tries. He's got that kind of air about him.
Yeah, he's sort of a crumpled man, isn't he? One thing in this episode that you do hear about 50 times is Joss Ackland going, "Stinker!"
Yeah, that's right. "My old stinker!" Which is something you're going to call your old fella, isn't it?
Someone should do a little supercut just of all the times Joss Ackland says, "My old stinker! My old stinker! Stinker! My old stinker!"
I'm going to do that and stick it on the end of the episode.
Yeah, you should.
I'm going to.
You should.
Yeah,
it'd be lovely.
That's it. You've convinced me. Yeah, I will. But back in modern day, 1981, Cutler sort of effectively kidnaps Tinker and takes him to a posh restaurant for lunch.
Yeah, he does.
He's got that sort of Brian Blessed approach to acting by sort of screaming everything at the top of his voice. He sort of says, what are you doing for lunch, Stinker? And he goes, "Oh, I haven't decided." "You have now." And just drags him along to a restaurant. Which, again, I suppose, as far as this role goes, it is the perfect comparison, because Denham Elliot is very simpering.
Yeah.
And he's, and so that sort of loud, shouting, booming, almost sort of General Melchett kind of approach really does show. And then they go to the restaurant. The size of that lunch.
It's
amazing. It's that for lunch, yeah.
He's spooning out heaps of Stilton.
Yeah, it's like a Close Encounters pile of Stilton, isn't it? It's amazing. Yeah.
I know who's going to be a stinker after that.
Oh, God. My old stinker.
And a giant glass of port.
Oh, God. Then he sort of says, "What do you do for a living, my old stinker?" And it turns out that Tinker, Harold Tinker, he estimates the price of paint for a living. That's his job.
Mm.
He sort of looks at paint and goes, £10. That's his job. And so then he says he gets paid £4,500 a year. I think, no bloody wonder. So Cutler immediately says, come on, work for me and I'll double it. So he'll give him like $9,000 a year.
Yeah.
Which again, in 1981, I think adjusted for inflation, that's probably about £200,000.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
Easy. Yeah. He tries to think about it, but he goes back to his house and he sees his wife. Tinker's there with his wife, Phil.
Mm.
Short for Phyllis, which as we said is played by
Patricia Quinn
is playing Phil,
because she does complain of the fact that he's had the same job for 10 years, same house, sort of going nowhere. She very much pressures him into accepting this role despite his very obvious misgivings and his painful history with Jack,
which she's not too bothered about. She just says it's adolescent boy's beastliness.
Yeah
Which it is, really.
It is.
But then he sort of says, oh, I had the same trouble with my father. So we then get another flashback, this time to old Father Tinker.
This is where I actually like to think of this story as a spin-off sequel to Indiana Jones. It's Marcus Brody as the father.
That's good.
Because, you know, he's sort of a bit hardened, drunken after his adventures with Indy.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want his son to grow up to be a bit of a sort of a wimp like he was. Yeah, it's Marcus Brody's son.
That's fascinating, because Marcus Brody was the next role that Denham Elliott did after doing this.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Because he does tell a story about how he was in the jungle and he ran away, basically. That's his story of bravery, was he just fucked off.
Exactly. It all fits.
Which is brilliant. But we then see that Tinker, he's still got his father's old service revolver. He keeps it hidden in a desk drawer in the living room.
As you do.
Which is a little foolish. Yeah. But because of that, he's decided that his stance is to take the job, and that's his way of standing up to the bullies, is to go and work for them.
To go and, your livelihood depend on one of them, yeah.
To tell him to fuck off would have been a much better stand, I think. But no, what do I know?
I'll show you. I'll be indentured servitude.
That's right, I'll be homeless without you. That'll teach you. So he starts working for Cutler, and he's already earning his keep. He's identified some reps who are submitting some false invoices and fleecing the company.
To the tune of £9,000 a year or something.
Yeah. Again, quite a lot. That's one Tinker's salary.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So the Cutler's very pleased. Mm. And again, he keeps calling him my old stinker.
Yeah.
Which is it's just a knob euphemism. It's wonderful. And then Cutler does a very lengthy monologue about his Rolls Royce and how he's driven by his chauffeur, young Meech.
Mm.
Then he invites the Cutlers for dinner, and he says, and we'll use the Rolls. So having soup, presumably. They're in the Rolls, and it's brilliant. He's got one of those pull-out drinks cabinets in the back of the car.
It's still a very tight squeeze in the back there. It's not... It's not.
It is. They're snuggled up together in the back.
There's three of them. You would have thought there'd maybe be a little bit more space. There's three of them, and they're just basically sitting on each other's laps, and we're supposed to be like, you know, this luxurious vehicle.
The interiors are done in like a Rover Metro or something, aren't they? All snuggled up. And this is where Joss Ackland really starts getting like lascivious and lecherous.
He really does, yeah.
He's just sort of going, gin makes you sin, when Phil asks for a gin and tonic.
And Phyllis is wearing a nice new dress, and he's just like, oh, God, that's a great dress. Oh, God.
Yeah, like to see you out of it, or something like that. Yeah.
Leaves a bit to the imagination, but not too much.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Stinker's just sitting there, sort of simpering away, looking inevitably about to be cuckolded.
And as they're going into the house, he just does it once more. And I did write down the comment he says about her dress. And he says, I must say, that dress is really grrr, is the actual line that he says.
He does the sort of...
but the fun in Maryland is stopped by Cutler's wife, who turns up.
Yeah.
Which is Yvonne Stewart Hargreaves from Heidi High.
Yeah.
One of the ballroom dancers.
Oh my God. Because I recognised her. I recognised her face, but I was like, because obviously she looks totally different because she's in sort of a grey, long
Yeah,
sort
she's
of wig.
Got like a grey wig thing on.
She had short black hair, didn't she, in Heidi High? She had
short. It was like sort of short, sort of red hair. Short it was her and Barry. Come away, Barry. Yeah, Diane Holland.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. I just burst out laughing
when
I saw her there. It's just so funny. So they have a dinner, and basically Joss Ackland and Phyllis get absolutely arsehole.
Yeah, and...
and just guffaw boorishly throughout the whole movie.
And he's just got this giant phallic cigar in his mouth. And Phil is sort of mocking, openly mocking her husband about how he got the nickname Stinker, and because it was because he was terrible with women.
Yeah, his performance with girls.
And then she sort of says to Cutler that, you know, I bet you he had better.
Not as good as you, yeah.
It was really awful. It's really horrible.
It's so uncomfortable. And then the next thing we see is Phil sort of practically getting carried home by the chauffeur, young Meech. He drops her off.
Yeah.
And then she falls out with Tinker in the living room with Harold, saying that oh, he's very sexy, that Jack Cutler, isn't he? And then he says, oh, he's a bit old for you, isn't he? But they were in school together.
Yeah.
So they're obviously the same age.
Yeah. So he's implying that he's too old for her as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because then we get the reveal, of course, that he says, I thought young door-to-door salesman, more your type.
Yes.
And then she says, oh, come on, you know, we thought we were sort of going to move past that. And he said, well, I haven't. So we learn, actually, she's not just really rude and obnoxious. She's actually a bit of a, you know...
enjoys the pleasure of visiting gentlemen.
She likes a bit of stinker.
She prefers a young stinker.
Partial to a young stinker.
But then she tries to dance with Harold when she's drunk, which is, you know, sort of a suggestion of a promise.
Mm.
But he refuses and pushes her down. Mm. So he really is a stinker with girls, because that was his chance.
That was a sure thing, yeah.
Yeah. And then she starts with the Tinker Stinker. She starts winding him up about the nickname, which, of course, he doesn't like.
No.
So then the next day, we're in Harold's office. Mm. Cutler comes in and apologises for overstepping the mark.
Yeah.
And then, rather decently, he says... should we drop the whole stinker thing?
Yeah.
Because I can tell you don't really like it.
Yeah,
so, as you said, this is the bit where he's a little bit sympathetic and he's showing a little bit... he's not really a git. He's just a bit of a fool.
Yeah.
And he realised it's gone too far, so we'll just stop that.
Yeah. And he sort of implies that he got in a dog box quite badly with his own wife. Yeah.
Understandably. Yeah, she wouldn't let him sleep in the chalet that night, would she? So, but then Cutler says he's going off for the rest of the day for a game of golf. He goes off in the rolls.
Mm.
Tinker's not feeling very well, so he tells the secretary he's off home for the day. Catches the bus home. And the rolls is parked outside his house.
Bloody hell, Cutler is a cad after all.
Yep, because it definitely is his, because the license plate, 4JC.
Yeah.
It's definitely his rolls.
You think it was owned by a priest or a nun or something, 4JC.
Or John Cleese. But rather than sort of rush in and confront Jack, he goes to the nearest phone box and calls home and says, I'm not feeling very well, I'm on my way home. Mm. And the Rolls Royce immediately speeds away.
Yeah.
So clearly caught in the act.
Yeah.
And as if to sort of add some more evidence, there's a cigar in the bin right by the bed.
Yeah, not very good at covering a tracks at all.
No, not very good.
I would have thought if you're going to have an illicit affair, perhaps you wouldn't let your lover smoke a cigar in the boudoir.
How are you going to explain that one away?
I mean, you know, that takes hours for that smell to go, you know.
Foul. That is an old stinker.
So
now Tinker's had enough.
Mm.
He's had enough of bullies, he's had enough of being bullied, and he's enough of being called inadequate.
Yeah.
So he storms into Cutler's office.
With Marcus Brody's revolver.
Yeah. And Cutler says, what do you think you're doing, my old stinker? So he is about to call him Stinker again.
Yeah.
But then there's a bang. And Cutler looks at him, his eyes wide, that leery grin still on his face. And the camera backs up. And there's a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead. And he falls down dead.
Yeah.
It's a good death. That expression on his face is brilliant. And that's the bit I remember.
Yeah, I like it when they do a bullet hole like that as well. Just like the actual hole before the blood comes out, you know.
Yeah.
It's effective.
Yeah. So he's done it. He's shot Cutler.
Yeah.
What he's going to do from here, I don't really know.
Mm.
But that's it. He's stood up to the bully. So he gets the bus home, as all murderers do.
And you're fleeing in a panic. You get the bus. Yeah.
As he's approaching the house, the Rolls is parked outside the house again.
What? Oh, God.
So he goes in the house.
Yeah.
And his wife's in bed with a man smoking a cigar. But it's the chauffeur. It's Meech.
Yeah.
So he realised, my God, what have I done? I've killed the wrong man. Yeah. Cutler was actually being quite nice after all. Yeah. So he runs into the bathroom, looks into the mirror, and he starts repeating the chant. A stinker fails in everything he tries.
Yeah.
I am a stinker.
Yeah.
and then shoots himself in the face.
Yeah, and Patricia Quinn gets a hell of a fright when she hears the gunshot.
She does. Yeah. It's almost like someone's popped a balloon behind her or something. Yeah. And does that really weird freeze frame shot. Like we've said before, these end very, very suddenly.
Yeah.
And this one is no different. She just, jumps, and that's the end.
Yeah.
End of episode.
Mm. And what did you think of this one?
Despite thinking it was the wrong thing, I really enjoyed this one. I thought this was really good.
Yeah.
The twist at the end wasn't that heavily signposted, so it was still a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
You knew something was going to happen and something slightly different, but the chauffeur wasn't that prominent and they didn't talk about it that much. No. They actually referred to the chauffeur in the roles just as him being a little ostentatious about the whole thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't really, I've got a chauffeur. It was just him showing off.
Yeah.
So it was a nice little jarring surprise at the end.
Yeah.
Like with some of them, I didn't feel it had dated that much either. No. Because a lot of them, you know, the music's all electronic and they look like they've been filmed in a really crappy TV studio. I think maybe because this one was filmed on location, it didn't feel as aged as some of them have. I think the three leads were brilliant. Denham Elliott and Joss Ackland were just outstandingly good. And Patricia Quinn also, because she's just horrible in it as well.
Yeah.
Really kind of boorish and awful.
Yeah,
it's really well written.
Mm.
It's a good story.
Yeah.
Unlike The Umbrella Man, which was, you know, about 20 minutes of padding, this is really, really well paced. Didn't feel rushed, didn't feel padded. It fitted that sort of 23 minutes absolutely perfectly. So, yeah, I really liked it. I thought this was a good one. Mm. How about you?
I really enjoyed this. You know, it had a sense of inevitability about it. You knew that this downtrodden, victimized stinker was going to snap. You just knew he was going to snap at some point. Mm. So, you know, it was inevitable. And it was sort of like, okay, who's he going to snap at and how's he going to do it and how's he going to get away with it? I was still, you know, not quite sure where it was all going. And then, you know, I thought, oh, okay, it does seem a bit obvious. Oh, he shot Cutler. Oh, okay. And that surprised me. And it was like, okay, so what's next? I mean, that can't just be it because that's inevitable that was going to happen. How is he going to actually, okay, the twist is going to be that he's going to somehow get away with this somehow. Then when he got home and the Rolls was there, the penny just dropped for me at that moment and I felt quite sort of stupid that I hadn't sort of picked up on it. And it's such a good feeling to have just sort of been a little bit behind the twist a bit.
Yeah,
and
then the penny drop is great.
Yeah, and it all made sense that, you know, it wasn't signposted, but, you know, the hint about she likes her men younger than both Cutler and Tinker, and the fact that Meech had kind of had to effectively sort of manhandle her into the family home after that drunken night. You can sort of see how they might have exchanged a few looks or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a really effective twist. I thought the performances were great. There's no real fat on it. You know, it was just a nice, quite nasty, sleek.
It's even got sort of like red herrings for something so short.
Mm.
It's even got little red herrings about what is, like you said, is he going to get away with something? Because he's investigating people who are stealing from the company.
Yeah.
One of the potential twists could have been, it was him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because there is another Tales of the Unexpected, which is like that. There's an American one set in a bank where there's a lot of theft going on.
Yeah.
And the manager is a very downtrodden, very much like Tinker.
Yeah.
And he's asked to investigate it, and they're always accusing him. And he's always saying, no, it's not me. I've proven it. I've proven it's not me.
Mm.
And, of course, at the end, it turns out that it is him.
Yeah.
And he gets away with it. So there's a lot of things that he could have done and gotten away with.
Yeah, I thought when he started working for him and, you know, proving that he was quite smart operator that, oh, okay, so this is how he's going to get his revenge on Cutler after all those years. He's going to do something, to do with the business or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Did keep me guessing, and it ended up being a little bit more straightforward, but it just had that one little twist at the end that was quite tragic and, you know, in the end, the person that I really feel sorry for is Cutler.
It's true, actually.
Yeah, and to be fair, when he was going to call him Stinker that last time, he did have a gun pointed at him. So perhaps he thought, wow, yeah, you're pointing a gun at me. I am going to go there with the Stinker.
I'm going to call you a Stinker, yeah.
So, no, I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was very good.
Great, yeah. Out of the many, many that I've seen, this is definitely one of the best ones.
I agree.
Such high quality with everything about it. It's really good.
Yeah, nice.
So, let's talk about what's happening next. I think it's your choice next, isn't it?
It is my choice next. You can call it sort of relatively new fatherhood on the brain, but I've gone for something that's kind of baby-themed. Ooh. It's a film that people don't really talk about these days. It really gets a mention, I think. But at the time, I remember at the time, I think I was 9 or 10 when this came out. It was pretty huge and it did really good box office.
Okay.
And I remember really, really loving this as a kid and thinking it was just absolutely hysterical. And I'm referring to Look Who's Talking.
Wow, that film was massive.
It was pretty big, wasn't it? It was pretty big.
Absolutely.
So, of course, everyone's favourite Scientologists, Kirstie Alley and John Travolta. The voice of Bruce Willis as the baby.
Yes.
So, yes, Look Who's Talking.
Great stuff. Mm. I'm looking forward to that. That'll be good.
Mm, mm.
Probably about time to wrap it up. It's 10 past 10 at night.
Oh, yes.
I've got work in the morning. I'm sure you do as well.
Indeed.
So it's time to do our traditional bit of housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you want to email us, StillAnyGood@gmail.com. And please, please, please remember to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Yay, please do that.
That would be nice.
All right.
I will see you very, very soon.
Indeed.
Where we will talk about a baby Bruce Willis.
Oh, when you put it that way. Can't wait. All right. Okay.
See you soon.
See
ya. Cheerio, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stinker! Fire away, my old stinker. Fire away. What are you doing with yourself, my old stinker? Well done, my old stinker. You're a dark horse, aren't you, my old stinker? Tinker, stinker, tinker. Play on words, that's all. From now on, perhaps you'd better drop it. No more stinker, agreed. What do you think you're doing, my old stinker?